Employer Rules and Norms During COVID-19. As everything from dentist's office to restaurants begin to reopen, more and more people are returning to their workplaces after spending weeks at home. And there are new questions about the relationship between employer and employee. There are also new laws. For example, under the CARES Act, employers can take the temperature of people who work for them, something most would never have dreamed of before. But can supervisors insist that employees wear masks? Will employees lose their unemployment benefits if they refuse to return to work? What is now considered a reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we lean on experts to help employers and employees navigate the HR minefield of reopening workplaces. That's next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As some COVID-19 restrictions are being lifted, more workplaces are starting to bring employees back into the office. With this transition comes many questions about rights and rules and how they apply to employers and employees. Today, we're going to discuss some of those questions. Joining me, Kristen Aiello, who is managing attorney focused on civil rights advocacy at Disability Rights Maine. David Chulo is president of Career Management Associates. And Catherine Rand is an attorney with Pierce Atwood, specializing in employment law. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always, we want to hear from you. Are you facing an issue or worried about something as you return to work? What happens if you don't feel comfortable going back into the office? And what is an employer allowed to look into in terms of a staff member's health status? You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. David, I'll start with you. Are there general guidelines that you are giving to the employers you work with as they seek to bring back their employees? What do they need to be thinking about now that they may not have had on their radar before the pandemic?
Well, you know, Jennifer, first, thank you for letting me be on the show today. I appreciate it. It's great being back on. Look, you know, the state has provided some great checklists and guidelines that are very clear of what employers need to be doing in preparing their employees for coming back. But there really are, of course, two situations. One, essential businesses that maybe have already been back, never left, and also businesses that are returning to work. So you do have this group of individuals, this group of people who have been working, who have been in the thrusts and throes of all this situation, and employers have figured out how to do it. So employers that are coming back are simply saying, what do we need to do? What are the factors? How do we make and ensure that our employees are comfortable and feeling good about it? And part of it is a fear factor that we have to work through. And the more we follow the guidelines, the more we understand what they are. The state has actually done a good job. The CDC has done a good job of at least putting this information out there. And that's where we start. We tell them, hey, there are checklists, there are guidelines. Let's take a look at that first. And then, of course, we'll deal with the individual situations. And those, of course, are the tricky ones.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, I know you're spending a large part of your time these days answering questions from employers and holding webinars. What are some of the biggest questions you're getting?
I think one of the biggest questions is first of all employers are in different situations. Some of them can open but don't have a lot of work for employees to do, so they're sort of in one bucket. Others can open and have employees who are really reluctant to come back to work, and that's a different bucket. And so that's how I'm spending most of my day is talking to sort of one category of employers who are having to make tough decisions about whether they can hold people's jobs or need to furlough people or lay them off, even though the state is slowly reopening. And then this other category that's ready to get back to business as usual as much as they can, but that's not necessarily where the rest of the world is.
Kristen, I understand there's some specific changes now. For example, employers can now take the temperature of employees, which, of course, they couldn't before. What else? What else is specific like that that's different now?
Yeah, thanks, Jen. That's a great question. I think, you know, first of all, I would direct folks to look at the EEOC guidance, the Equal Employment Opportunity Guidance, which talks a lot about how inquiries have changed since the pandemic was declared by the CDC. So prior to, like in January or February, if Katie Rand got a call from one of her clients and they said, "Hi, Katie, we're thinking about taking the temperature of all our employees before they walk into the building." I'm guessing that Katie's heart would skip a couple beats because that's definitely something that the ADA would not allow prior to the declaration that the pandemic is a direct threat. What that means is employers can now screen people basically for safety to try to ensure a safe workplace. And the EEOC put out guidelines because the CDC guidelines and the Americans with Disabilities Act provisions in some ways could have clashed prior to, you know, if there were no guidelines to help employers figure out what their rights were to ask of employees. So at this point, things like taking temperatures of every employee before they walk into the building, asking if they have symptoms like fever, chills, cough, shortness of breath, or sore throat, those are all inquiries that employers can make of current employees. Prior to the pandemic, before a direct threat was declared by the CDC, there were real limitations on what employers can ask during employment. So prior to this time, they wouldn't be able to ask that unless they had a specific reason of concern, and it was related to the necessity of the business to ask. So that's a big change that I think employers are getting used to and having to do since the declaration of the pandemic. I think what's important to keep in mind is that the ADA, as the EEOC has said, should not interfere with or prevent employers from following the Centers for Disease Control and Public Health guidelines during the pandemic. So that's a kind of, it's a common sense thing that if there is a pandemic happening, then employers should be able to screen those who are coming into the workplace. Conversely, if an employee is working from home, teleworking, the employer can't just ask to take their temperature because they're not seeking to get into the workplace in order to do their job. So things have changed somewhat, but it's important to remember that the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was enacted, it's almost 30 years now, it was enacted in July of 1990 originally, they're still very much in effect. I think the EEOC and the CDC are working well together in terms of saying, you know, encouraging employers to keep their workplace safe and to be able to ask these questions of employees going into the workplace.
David, one of the big issues here, isn't it, is confidentiality. If somebody isn't able to come to the workplace or doesn't want to come to the workplace because they have, for example, a pre-existing condition that puts them at higher risk of contracting COVID-19, but they don't want their coworkers to know, how does a company deal with that?
You know, that is a very realistic scenario, and certainly employers are dealing with that each and every day, especially in what we talked about here a few minutes ago. Imagine coming in and you're taking temperatures and somebody sees that you're, you know, maybe you're in a line, you're coming into the building and your temperature's being taken, you're sent home maybe, and there's a lot of questions. Look, at the bottom line at the end of the day, and I'll let Katie give the lawyer answer for this, but the very practical answer is this, is that we have been telling clients, as well as I know the guidance has been, that safety first. And then in this particular case, the most important thing that we're dealing with is making sure that the masses are taken care of and that it's a safe place to work. And then employers are dealing with the realities of making sure that their employees are safe and their clients are safe, their vendors, and maybe their customers, depending upon who they are. And so, yes, confidentiality is key, and we tell and teach supervisors and employers and owners that you can't go out and say, you know, hey, John has a fever, or Mike has whatever it may be, or Betsy has something. You really can't say that. What you can simply say is, look, they're not here today, and that we really can't give you any more information. Now, if there is a direct threat to the organization in regards to maybe someone does have COVID and something is on site, then we recommend get guidance through your employment attorney in regards to how you want to respond independently. But in this particular case, as a general rule, yes, you need to keep that information confidential. Yes, you want to look at the safety of each and every person that is there. And you want to make sure you can, to the best of your ability, keep information confidential.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, I'm guessing, you know, that might be really difficult, especially if somebody does come back to work, does have COVID-19, and other employees have to be told there was someone you worked with who had COVID-19, you need to get tested, and there's one person who's out. I imagine that this is really tricky.
Yeah, it is. That is one thing that hasn't changed, though, with COVID-19, the ADA's confidentiality requirements. So I would say that is an area that employers, or ones that understand their legal obligations, have always been really tuned into and always really cautious about, and that's true now, too. And it is certainly true that there may be circumstances where the workplace is able to sort of piece together or figure out what's going on with a particular employee or who it is that they had close contact with, that they're now being advised, you know, they've had close contact with someone. They may be able to figure that out and speculate. And that happened in the workplace around medical issues before COVID-19, and it will still happen. That doesn't change the employer's responsibility to protect the employee's confidentiality. And so there won't be names mentioned. And, you know, there needs to be, you know, discouraging of talking about people's personal situations, frankly, medical or otherwise, medical under the ADA, and that's continued too. So it's dicey, but I think it's an old problem with sort of a new face.
Yeah. Kristen, are you concerned at all about harassment? We've already heard people who have COVID-19 say they feel like they're wearing a scarlet letter.
Yeah, there is concern there. I remember during the H1N1 days, we would get calls at Disability Rights Maine of people who were being treated differently because of fear of or the perception that they had had a disability or H1N1. Now, when it comes to harassment, the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, specifically forbids harassment in the workplace. Other laws also forbid harassment based on other protected classes. In this situation, there are two that are highlighted, I think, that the EEOC has talked about the consequence of COVID being called the Chinese virus and use of derogatory terms leading to harassment of individuals of Asian descent or perceived as such. And that has been a real concern of the EEOC, who actually issued a statement on that. We're also concerned about our clients with disabilities or those who are perceived to have disabilities or, having disabilities in the workplace. So because of fear surrounding the pandemic, employees sometimes go back to work after a positive diagnosis, after they've recovered, or they're caring for a family member with COVID. And we are certainly concerned that they could be subjected to harassment or discrimination based on actual or perceived disability. And I think, you know, a healthy workplace involves informing employees of their rights and of the zero tolerance for harassment. So we would hope that employers are doing their job by, you know, educating their workforce on the issue of harassment. Which is, you know, any kind of unwelcome comments, jokes, acts, or other verbal or physical conduct that targets an individual based on their protected class.
Let me ask you, though, Kristen, about the concept of disability in terms of COVID-19. We have a huge group of people who have a reason that they are more susceptible to COVID-19 than others, underlying conditions such as disability. Underlying conditions such as COPD or diabetes or obesity, age, a whole group of people who may be worried about returning to the workplace because of something that wasn't really considered a disability in the workplace before. Is it now?
Well, you know, That it certainly could be. You know, keep in mind that there are 61 million people in the United States who are considered to have a disability, according to the CDC in 2018. 26 people, one in four have a disability. The ADA is the most comprehensive civil rights law in the country addressing some of these issues. And yes, you have, I think, of concern, and it's of note through the CDC. They actually list different conditions or different diagnoses of people who are at higher risk for severe illness, people with chronic lung disease, asthma, serious heart conditions, people who are immunocompromised, are at increased risk, according to the CDC. And so when they go back to work, they're very concerned often that they could contract COVID and end up having a real severe consequence. So the EEOC has reiterated, and we reiterated Disability Rights Maine, that if an individual has an underlying health condition that could be exacerbated or they're at serious risk of harm by going back into the workplace, they have the potential right to reasonable accommodation. It could be teleworking. It could be a temporary leave to allow them to get back to work when things are better. It could be also, if teleworking or other options aren't possible, looking at what measures that can the employer take to reduce the threat that person could contract COVID. I do want to underscore here that just because the CDC has a list of different disabilities or conditions, that doesn't mean that an employer can automatically say, oh, you're over age 65 or you have heart disease, you have to leave the workplace. That would be discrimination based on disability. But when it comes to looking at, you know, getting people back into work, if an employer is aware that a person has an underlying condition that puts them at risk, a good practice could be for the employer, if they already know of the condition, to make an offer to talk about, you know, are you interested in teleworking? Is this something that could be helpful? An employer isn't under an obligation to do that, and you know, typically it individual would need to make that request for accommodation, but at least it opens up the lines of communication to allow some discussion about, you know, people at higher risk by going into the workplace.
What are your questions about? Oh, yeah, go ahead, Katie.
I was just going to say that's a really good point, and I'm not surprised, but glad to hear we see this the same way. Something that I think most employers or those that I work with have their employees' best interests at heart. And so there can be a tendency for a company to sort of take a paternalistic approach towards somebody who is at higher risk but who may not be fearful or who may not be interested in an accommodation or a change in the workplace. And I think it's really – the point you just made is a really important one, which is that employers really need to take their lead. They can open a dialogue, and in fact – I would encourage them to, but they really need to take the lead of the individual as opposed to making assumptions about what the individual needs or what's good for them.
We're talking about...
It's always a bad idea to make assumptions. That's true.
We are talking about the change in what has and hasn't changed as people go back to work with the employer-employee relationship rules and norms. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And the Damariscotta River Grill, celebrating 17 years of grown-up comfort food, now open for dine-in service. Learn more at damariscottarivergrill.com.
Congress sent states and cities billions of dollars in aid, yet many places have gotten nothing. Some mayors are being told to spend city money first to fight the pandemic, then they'll qualify for federal help.
Well, whoop-de-doo. I haven't got any money to fight the pandemic. My fight of the pandemic is go in your house and stay there.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. The daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is scheduled to take place at 2 this afternoon. Governor Mills is expected to join Dr. Shah and others today as she unveils the administration's proposal to protect the health and safety of Maine people and visitors during this year's tourism season. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shah and Governor Mills at 2 this afternoon and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are discussing the many legal issues and other concerns between employers and employees brought on by the pandemic. My guests are David Chulo, president of Career Management Associates, Catherine Rand, Katie Rand, employment law attorney with Pierce Atwood, and Kristen Aiello, managing attorney with Disability Rights Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now is Laura Fortman, who's the Commissioner of Maine's Department of Labor. Thank you for calling in, Commissioner.
My pleasure, Jennifer.
Laura, big article in the New York Times just recently. In many states, employees who refuse to go back to work during this COVID crisis are being denied unemployment claims. What is the policy in Maine? Can someone who is afraid to return to work lose their unemployment benefits?
Well, the short answer is it depends. I mean, anyone who is offered their job back must accept that job unless there is a good cause. And with COVID-19, the good cause could be something like they were themselves diagnosed with COVID-19. They may have a breadwinner who died because of COVID-19. They may have to take care of someone at home. There are a number of reasons that, at least for the pandemic unemployment assistance program, that there may be good reason to not accept a job. We have a chart on our website that people can look at. However, generally speaking, if you are offered a job, you must take that position. We are encouraging employers to work with employees. So, for example, the employer may have a telework opportunity that someone could accept. And, of course, if someone is receiving any sort of paid sick leave or other paid benefits, they would not be eligible for unemployment insurance.
So would just being afraid of catching COVID-19 not be good enough cause?
Yeah, probably not. What we would do is we would hold a fact-finding hearing with the employer. That would be one session, and then with the employee, and do an analysis of the situation. But generally speaking, just being concerned would probably not be enough. You know, you may have some underlying health issues that make that concern more real, that's really a health risk for you, and that would be taken into consideration.
And how about if you live with someone who has an underlying condition? Is that something that would fit that good cause definition?
Well, it's definitely one of those situations that we would want to look at and talk to both the employee and the employer. Again, it's not as clear-cut as we would, as people would like. These are situations where we're going to have to listen to both the employer and the employee and make an evaluation based on the individual circumstances in that particular case.
Great. Commissioner Fortman, we have a couple questions coming in that I think are more specifically for you than our other guests. So before we say goodbye, I'm going to run these by you. This is an email from S. I am a small essential business owner. When COVID-19 hit Maine, we had 10 full-time equivalent employees. One of my key staff left on a self-initiated unemployment because he had a doctor's letter. Both he and his wife were deemed high risk and he qualified for COVID-19 related unemployment benefits. I will be 71 years old this coming Friday and have been having to work the departed individual's position as well as continue to run the business. Performing these duties now requires I work 78 hours per week with no end in sight. Due to the persistence of new COVID-19 cases, the unemployed individual understandably cannot give me a return to work date. What are my obligations to keep his position open for his unknown return? Hold on, I just lost that here. And what are the consequences if I hire someone else to fill the position to relieve me of my current workload?
Yeah, in Maine, the individual may be eligible for unemployment insurance. Unfortunately, there are not clear job protections that go along with that. So employers may make a business decision to terminate someone's employment based on need. We are an at-will state. I know most employers do not want to do that because they have relationships with their employees. You know, in a mere 13 weeks ago, we were all in a situation where everyone was, looking for any employee anywhere. So I know employers do not want to terminate the employment relationship with people. And so we're encouraging people to try to work together, both the employer and the employee. But there are not unemployment insurance is not job protected leave.
All right. And I'm going to go to Sandy, who's calling from Stockholm. Sandy, if you could ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Hi. Thank you. I'm unemployed. My employer requested that I come back to work on a certain date, but my doctor said I shouldn't do it because of certain health conditions and my age. So 3 weeks have gone by, and it's very difficult to get all that information through when you do your recertification every week. So I don't know. I haven't received any unemployment compensation for the 3 weeks since I told them I was requested to come back to work. Mm-hmm. But I do have a doctor's note. What should I do with the doctor's note?
Hang on to the doctor's note, and we will be scheduling a fact-finding where we will gather that information. And if it's determined in your favor, the unemployment benefits will be retroactive. And I do want to just assure people that we are in the process of hiring additional adjudicators to handle these fact-findings so that we can move through them more quickly.
And Commissioner Fortman, right now, what does the delay look like? What should Sandy expect until she has that adjudication?
Yeah, well, I don't know the specifics of her case, so I don't know if it's already been scheduled or not. So I can't answer her specific case, I apologize for that.
Okay. Sandy, thank you so much for your call. So many questions coming in similar to that that call, the questions about I can't come back to work. So and Commissioner Fortman, before we let you go, I know the last time you were on the show, you were working through a backlog of claims. How is that going? Is there still a backlog, and how many days?
Well, I think since we talked last, Jennifer, we also got hit with fraud.
That's right.
Yeah. So things are definitely every week there is a new and interesting challenge. We have a team working specifically on working through some of the ID theft cases. Again, for people who know anything about that, this was not identities that were stolen from the Department of Labor. These are criminals who have accessed that personal identification information from the dark web and are using it to file unemployment claims in other people's names. It's fraudulent UI claims. And we're working closely with law enforcement. And in fact, we've got a team of law enforcement folks who are going through the identification with us here so that we can work through those claims. We held about 12,000 claims to review last week, and we're working through them as quickly as possible.
Wow. Well, thanks for calling in. Laura Fortman is Maine's Commissioner of the Department of Labor. Going to go to a question from Billy on Facebook. What is expected of factories such as commercial bakeries where it is too hot to wear masks all day, but it is also not possible to social distance due to the nature of the work? What can or should they be doing to help keep employees as safe as possible? David, I'm going to let you tackle that one.
Oh, that's a good one. You know, and manufacturing is one of those areas that we are seeing that situation. And, I mean, look, ideally, we are encouraging and continuing to encourage the use of masks, and that it is there are some masks now that have what we call a cooling product to them. They are available where, just like you wear a T-shirt that sometimes cools down, the fabric can be used and be pulled over in a mask form that actually has more of a cooling effect than just a standard, if you want to call it a standard mask. But the reality is that is a challenge. And part of the issue that we're seeing is that some of this happens where these are essential businesses, and we're seeing it on construction sites and other areas where it's just extremely hot to wear this gear. We are encouraging employers to look at additional breaks, additional time away, different ways to maybe cool down the site or other areas to make that happen. But that is an issue. And so employers, I know, just like Katie was saying, that 99% nine employers want to do the right thing. It's just working through employees and asking them how we can do this better and how can we do this in a different shift capacity. So it is a challenge, but I do know that employers are working with different fabrics and other ways to try to make sure that they still continue to have the required protective gear, even in hot situations.
All right. We're going to go back to Sandy, who had the question by phone just a minute ago. And Kristen, I'll turn to you. How can an employee request a reasonable accommodation?
Yeah, so in a situation where an individual has an underlying condition that puts them at greater risk, or someone might have a mental impairment that's exacerbated by having to go back into the workplace to the point where they can't focus or concentrate, and they really want and need to work, but they just simply need some sort of a modification as folks are transitioning back to work. And what I would suggest to anyone who's looking to ask for an accommodation is, go to your supervisor, go to your manager, indicate to them that you're asking for a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. You're not required to use those words. There are no magical sort of words that are required, but using the term reasonable accommodation can be helpful if you can. Once you indicate that you need some sort of a modification at work, that begins a discussion with your employer. It's called the interactive process, and it's a process where both the employee and the employer participate together to talk about, okay, what this individual has a disability, what are the limitations that are resulting from that disability, and how do the limitations affect their ability to do the essential functions of the job? And so that sort of process of going back and forth and talking about how does the disability create a limitation, and then how will the requested accommodation effectively address the limitation? So someone who is at very high risk in going back into the office, that can include someone over 65, that could include someone who's pregnant. Neither of those are considered disabilities, but they may be relevant. Or someone with an underlying condition like a severe asthma or other condition that could be exacerbated. Talk about how the accommodation would address limitations. So if you're able to work from home, that could be, something that the employer can consider. The employer may suggest another form of accommodation that would effectively address the issue. And the employer is entitled to documentation from a provider if the disability isn't obvious. One of the points the EEOC makes in their guidance is that at this time, a lot of healthcare providers are really out straight, and it's difficult to get that sort of a note, quickly. And so employers want it, and hats off to employers who can be flexible and have shown how flexible they can be during this time. But one of the suggestions the EEOC makes is perhaps an employer could allow a temporary accommodation until such time as the, documentation could be provided, and then both parties can talk from then on, from there out. Sometimes if an employee has a difficult time communicating for whatever reason, someone could make the request for them, and that could start the interactive process as well.
All right. Calling in now is Grace Levitt, who's president of the Maine Education Association. Thanks so much for calling in, Grace.
Sure thing. Thank you.
As schools think about returning to classroom learning in the fall, what kind of unique issues face schools as opposed to other workplaces when we're having this discussion about employee rights under COVID-19? I know that Maine's teachers, many of them are older. Do many have underlying conditions, and how does that play into what we're looking at in the fall?
Well, this is a really complex question that we're certainly working on figuring out answers to, and so much is going to depend on what we're facing in terms of if we're able to get students back in person, if we need to have some sort of a hybrid model. A lot of folks are looking at what that would entail, or we may have to continue with remote learning for the time being. And so plans are being worked on for all of those possible scenarios, and certainly discussions will have to be had for assuming we do get back to in-person, which is everybody's goal, what needs to be in place to keep everybody safe? That is absolutely the top priority, both for staff as well as for students in the community.
I read a recent survey in Education Week magazine that showed more than half of educators do not want to return to the classroom learning in the fall. Is that what you're hearing from your members?
We're hearing some of that, certainly. I don't know a percentage that are feeling that way. It is a concern because we need those educators. In fact, we need, if anything, we need increased staff in order to put in to place some of the practices and protocols that we're looking at in terms of trying to reduce class sizes, limit the number of interactions and the movement of students throughout the day, and trying to be sure that we are doing everything possible to get back to in-person instruction and yet also have guidelines in place that are keeping people safe and dealing with this pandemic. So I can understand that feeling. Everybody's going to be at least somewhat concerned about that, if not greatly concerned, depending upon their circumstances. But we're hoping that there can be some discussions, as you've been hearing from the other speakers today as well, as far as what are some of the accommodations that can be made for people that have those needs, and how can we still be providing a good education, as we've been doing incredibly through all of this, to all of the students.
Well, Grace, thanks so much for calling in. That's Grace Levitt, president of the Maine Education Association. In the interest of full disclosure, we should note that the MEA also represents many of the employees at Maine Public. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. Bernstein Shore, a law firm that counsels clients through contracts and courtrooms, and the business challenges outside them. BernsteinShore.com. And Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
St. Croix Island near Calais is established as a U.S. National Monument on June 8, 1949. The island was the site of the first European settlement in Maine by Frenchman Pierre Duguay de Mons in 1604. The winter of 1604-1605 on St. Croix Island was a cruel one for Pierre Duguay's French expedition. Iced in by freezing temperatures and cut off from fresh water and game, 35 of 79 men died. Although the expedition moved on by summer, the beginning of French presence in North America had begun.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is scheduled to take place in just a few minutes at 2 this afternoon. Governor Mills is expected to join Dr. Shaw and others today as she unveils the administration's proposal to protect the health and safety of Maine people and visitors during this year's tourism season. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at mainepublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and Governor Mills at 2 this afternoon and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, mainepublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about issues between employers and employees raised by the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me, Katie Rand, who is an attorney with Pierce Atwood, Kristen Aiello, who's managing attorney at Disability Rights Maine, and David Chulo, president of Career Management Associates. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Here's an email from Julie, and Katie, I'll throw this one to you. She says she has a medical condition and had requested that she not have to return to work. Her employer is York Hospital, and she writes, I was terminated with a doctor's note because I, quote, refused, end quote, to return to work. My doctor is also a York Hospital physician. I thought this was illegal. Katie, is it illegal?
I can't weigh in on that. Whether that's illegal depends on so many facts and circumstances that I just don't know about, and it wouldn't be appropriate to weigh in on. But I would say, and when Commissioner Fortman was talking, I was thinking, and I bet Kristen was as well, that while the unemployment doesn't provide protections for employees' jobs, there are other protections under the ADA or the Maine Human Rights Act in some circumstances for an employee who's not able to work because of a disability. And so if there is an employee with a disability who's unable to return to work because of that, the employer has an obligation to consider whether providing them with an unpaid leave of absence and holding their position is a reasonable accommodation, or whether that would pose an undue hardship. And I think the answer to whether that's going to be reasonable or be an undue hardship or undue burden is really, really fact-specific. So, for example, we heard from either a caller or a gentleman who emailed in and said he's working 70 hours a week in order to cover for this individual who's not working. Perhaps that's an undue burden. In other situations, perhaps an employer can provide an employee with unpaid leave and get by without significant expense or difficulty, and that's a different situation. So highly fact dependent, but that was something that I wanted to add.
Right. And Katie, I know you don't want to talk about a specific case, but generally speaking, this concept of someone coming back to work, having a doctor's note that says they ought not come back to work, somebody being asked by their employer to come back to work and saying no, and I have a doctor's note, this person thought that it is just illegal to do that. And you're saying there's no blanket law that says somebody cannot be terminated.
I'm saying it depends. It depends. If the employee can't work because of a disability, there may be protections under the ADA or Maine Human Rights Act. If it's not because of a disability, there could be protections under the Family Medical Leave Act. So it's so individualized. But there certainly are situations in which there is not a protection for an employee, and the employer does not have to hold an employee's position.
I have an email here from Al. How about employees who claim to have anxiety or unable to wear a mask? And Chris, I want to ask you about that. One, can an employer require employees to wear a mask? And two, if so, would there be exceptions to that?
That's a good question. The CDC, I look to the CDC guidance, which talks about different measures that employers should take that can include using a mask. They do talk about having employees use masks when they're in sort of pass-through areas. Once they get to a space where they're within 6 feet of other people, it's possible that they could not wear the mask then. But the employer can make certain requirements to lessen the possibility of spread. That said, there are situations where it's possible that an employee is not able to wear a mask. Different scenarios that could come up: someone with a breathing disability could have a difficult time with a mask. Someone with a past history of trauma might have a very difficult time having a mask over their face, and that creates an inability to focus, concentrate, and could trigger panic. Sometimes you have individuals in the workplace who communicate by sign language or Sometimes folks who are hard of hearing may communicate partially by lip reading, and having someone wearing a mask makes it very difficult. So in that situation, they may want to ask for their supervisor or someone they're communicating with to wear a clear sort of mask, or different forms of accommodations that will not create a problem for someone with a disability. That these things are coming up more and more, both in the employment context and also in the public accommodation context in stores and so on. We're hearing more and more of those cases. But I think the important analysis to keep in mind is there another way to avoid the threat that the mask avoids? So by another form of mask, by social isolation, more so social distancing. And it's really a time where everyone has to be creative and keep an open mind and also use the tools that we have, like the CDC guidance, the EEOC guidance. The New England ADA Center also gives free advice to both employers and employees, counsel, different Disability Rights Center, Disability Rights Maine. We certainly give that sort of assistance to people with disabilities to think through how could, what could be suggested that would work.
All right, we're going to go to Linda. Linda is calling from Scarborough. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I work for a company that has several stores in the state, and one was featured in the Dr. Shah's CDC report last week, because 13 employees or 13 employees and related people were confirmed. I work at the Portland store, and I'm sort of at this point leery because we do have people going back and forth to each store. What are their obligations towards us? Can we get free testing as a result of this, or can we take a hiatus from work? Because this is sort of an unsteady situation. There's people going back and forth daily.
Right. Linda, thank you so much for the question. I'll start with you, David. If there are known COVID cases, multiple in a workplace, what is the employer's obligation to the employees, and what by law, and then what just ethically?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different pieces here, and I'm going to defer to Katie for the legal answer specifics, but I will say this. There is what we call the practicality of the situation, and what people are feeling is real. They are certainly concerned, and they may have some justification for the concern, especially if there is confirmed cases. That being said, there is very clear guidance on how to handle those situations in regards to removing people from the situation, obviously cleaning and making sure that the facility, as well as doing the temperature checks and everything else that needs to be done for employees that come in, to and from the building. Employers are going to continue to do what's right and make sure that they are taking care of all those protocols. But we also have to be, as has been said by Kristen and others, known that people do have fear. There is some concern and fear. And what we advise employers is very simple, is do everything you can, follow the rules to the best of your ability, provide that information and data to your employees and show them, because words are one thing and showing them is another thing, showing them that you're really doing the right things that you can do. And if you can limit, and again, I don't have specifics on this individual situation. I whenever we talk about any of these situations, they are so fact-specific. I know the others have talked about that too, and I'll also say the same thing. It's very fact-specific. And in that information, we just don't have enough to give you a specific answer, other than to say the employers are going to have to make sure the facilities are as close to the recommendations from the CDC and the state that they can make it.
Katie, what would you like to add to that?
Only that we have layers of sort of guidance to the employers. We have the checklist, then we have when there's a known confirmed case, we have the CDC, tracing, and hopefully those who've been in close contact with somebody who's tested positive are getting guidance to self-quarantine for a period of time, et cetera, et cetera. Assuming that the business is following all of those recommended guidelines, and that those who've had close contact are self-isolating, then there still may be a lingering fear among workers to go to work, and that's a totally reasonable, rational fear, perhaps, but one that there may not be anything that the employer can do to alleviate, which brings us back a little bit to Commissioner the discussion we had earlier around, you know, the availability of unemployment when employees are afraid to be in the workplace. Ultimately, beyond following the checklists and isolating those who've been in close contact, there is a layer of fear that probably no one and nothing can eliminate.
Jennifer, I'll add one more thing if I could, which is the fact that when we talk to employers, you know, sometimes people forget that even owners and leadership have fear too, and that they don't want to hurt anyone, and they don't certainly want to do what's wrong. They're trying to do everything they can, and I think all of us would agree that over the past 3 months, the rules and guidance has changed so fast, so rapidly, so quickly, that it has tested all of us in terms of our ability to, you know, Katie, I'm starting to feel part lawyer. And Kristen as well, you know, we're just trying to keep up with it. But remember, the employers know that their brand is at stake. Employers know that how they treat employees today will make a difference later. You know, it was only 3-4 months ago we couldn't find employees. So it's how fast the market changes. And so I would simply remind everyone that everybody is in the same boat, and we're trying to do what's best all the way across. I know employers are trying, and there has to be some give and take to make this work.
All right. And Kristen, we have about a minute left. I just go ahead and wrap it up if you could.
Okay. Thank you, Jen. I wanted to also add that keep in mind that other state laws come into play, like the Whistleblowers Protection Act protects individuals from discrimination if they, for their good faith refusal to carry out a directive to engage in an activity which would expose them to some sort of injury or death. So, for example, if someone's required to come to a site, there's a high risk of exposure, there's not protections being taken, then that employee needs to report that to their employer. And if it doesn't get resolved, then they could file a claim for violation of the Whistleblowers Protection Act.
Okay. I really appreciate all three of you. And Kristen, I wanted to sort of talk about very briefly something you and I talked about last week. You're not seeing cases yet because of the way that the law is written, right? You don't expect to see cases coming before the Maine Human Rights Commission for a few months, if at all.
Well, actually, we will start seeing cases coming before the Maine Human Rights Commission. It's just that there are no reported cases in court because individuals have to wait at least 6 months in order to get a right to sue letter to file in court. So there are no reported cases. Katie, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are no reported cases, I don't think, because individuals who bring employment discrimination claims have to bring those claims within 300 days, and then they're not able to go to court until 6 months have passed since they've been filed at, like, the Maine Human Rights Commission or the EEOC.
Yep.
So we're operating in uncharted territory in many ways here.
Yeah. And that, I guess, is a really important point to make right at the end, uncharted territory. I thank you all so much for spending time with us today. That was Kristen Aiello, Managing Attorney for Civil Rights Advocacy at Disability Rights Maine. David Chulo is President of Career Management Associates, and Katie Rand, an attorney with Pierce Atwood, specializing in employment law. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and today's program will rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's CDC briefing with Director Nirav Shah begins in a few minutes. He'll be joined today by Governor Mills. This will be on Maine Public Radio, television, and on our website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.